It's 3 o'clock. You're listening to Afternoon Classics at Premidi. Coming up at 4, All Things Considered from NPR News. We start the hour by heading to the interview studio with Judith Merriweather.
And joining me by telephone is a pretty amazing mother-daughter history team, Ashley Oliphant and Beth Yarbrough. They are here to talk about their book, Jean Lafitte Revealed, and it was published by the UL Press here on the UL campus. And they are making a book tour to let us know more about this book. Now, Ashley and Beth, as I mentioned before we went on air, I feel like I'm like a lot of people, even from Louisiana, who were never quite certain when you heard the name Jean Lafitte if he was real or not, or whether it was just a myth. that it was he was so shrouded in history, and even though there were, physical things like the Lafitte blacksmith bar, it just felt just lost in history if he had ever existed. Do you find that many people, even in Louisiana, are just not sure that he was a real person?
Well, not so much that, but you do get a lot of variance in the legends that you hear about Lafitte. They are varied, broad, wide, big and tall, and come a dime a dozen. So one of the tasks that we were faced with in trying to recount this tale was to make sure that we were not following the trail of some kind of a legend or myth as opposed to actual fact. And in that regard, we tried and succeeded, really, in basing our book on primary archival documents, which eliminated a lot of the question mark about, the very thing that you mentioned, is this myth or did it really happen?
Right. You weren't just going down to the coast of Louisiana and saying, has your family ever heard about Jean Lafitte?
No.
Well, now, the two of you are based in Lincolnton, North Carolina. How did you become interested in Jean Lafitte? Why was that a character of interest to the two of you?
So I am a writer who's published three books previously and was in between projects and knew that I wanted to write my next book about Jean Lafitte. I thought it was time for a new biography, particularly one written by a woman. There aren't a lot of women writing about pirates these days. was beginning the research on that book when on a family trip to New Orleans. In fact, my mother and I were having a lovely lunch at Antoine's and talking about the project. And she said, Ashley, she said, we've got that legend in Lincolnton that the man, Lorenzo Ferrer, who showed up in 1839, a mysterious Frenchman, people even in his time suspected that he might be the pirate Jean Lafitte living under an assumed name. She said, that sure would be a fun thing to explore. And she said, you may even get a chapter in the book out of an exploration of that history. And so when we returned from New Orleans, our bellies full of gumbo, we began to do the research. And I had actually invited her to join me because she knew so much about local history in Lincolnton. And it was very shortly thereafter that we started discovering things that nobody else had discovered before. And we recognized very early that I didn't need to write a new biography of Jean Lafitte. The mystery of Lorenzo Ferrer and whether he was the pirate Jean Lafitte was going to be our entire book. And so, as my mother said, with those primary archival documents, which we gathered in seven different states, we went as far west as Austin, Texas, and as far north as Princeton, New Jersey. We had a great Princeton story we'll share with you in a bit, but we were able to piece together those archival documents to prove that Lorenzo Ferrer actually was Jean Lafitte.
So he did not disappear into Barataria Bay some quicksand.
He did not. And, a lot of the death theories, and there were many of them from the years, say, 1822 to 1826, suggested that he died somewhere in the Gulf. or somewhere elsewhere in the Caribbean. And so many, many death theories to sort through. And we reach the, you know, the recognition that a man can only die one time, right? And we're looking at 15 different ways he died over a 4-year span. And we realized as well that not only were all but one of those death theories a lie, all of them were.
Incredible. Well, before we get to that, Lorenzo Farrar, part of his life, can you sketch out, and actually it's kind of interesting how little a part of the book this covers. I mean, his myth comes from what he did in Louisiana. So if the two of you could sketch out, you know, factual history, what did he do in Louisiana that made him such a notorious character? Why did those myths arise? Who was he connected to, and why did he make such an impact?
So he made such a name for himself in a couple of different ways. First, he started pirating about 100 years late. The golden age of piracy was completely over. And he decided to make sort of a last go of it. So when we think about the last traditional pirates, it really was him. And he was operating about 100 years after pirates like Blackbeard. The second thing that made him very unique was that he was about 75% businessman and about 25% pirate. And so he, in the Barataria Swamps, established one of the most successful black markets that has ever been organized in this country. At one point, at the height of his success, he was one of the 10 wealthiest men in America. And so he made a business as a middleman. He sent a fleet of 100 ships with more than 1,000 men out into the oceans to capture ships and bring stolen things in. His expertise really resided in his ability to organize and to find a place to sell the things that he had stolen. And so that's really how he made a name for himself. And so you ask the question, who were the people that he was associated with? He had his business partner. Many people suspect it was his brother, Pierre Lafitte. He had a very close friend who may have also been a brother. We were not 100% sure. Nobody is, in Dominique Yu. And then later, once the Battle of New Orleans began to take shape, he then comes into the circle of people like Andrew Jackson and Claiborne, Governor Claiborne. Lafitte was represented by Edward Livingston. His best friend was Arsène Latour. So one of the characteristics of Lafitte that really helped us to understand and recognize that was the same man that came to Mississippi and then to Lincolnton was that he always surrounded himself with very powerful, very well-connected people. And so that was really his New Orleans, Louisiana posse, so to speak.
And it sounds like with people such as the ones you mentioned he was connected to, there were lots of documents and things that, letters, I'm sure, and legal documents that were able to find.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, absolutely.
When you talk about, you know, the sheer volume of things that he brought into New Orleans, I remember reading I guess in John McGinnis's book, The Last Hayride, and he talked about New Orleans being kind of a cargo cult culture, where for a long period of time, particularly during the Jean Lafitte time, New Orleans got really used to just these goods just arriving on their shores that were very, very cheap and very luxurious, and that he really perpetuated that sense of sort of decadent luxury that we associate with New Orleans also.
He not only perpetuated it, he was probably one of the early early ones to recognize that it provided great potential for revenue, and he exploited that characteristic of New Orleans and built a huge business on it.
Right. Now, you do mention the Jean Lafitte blacksmith shop. Was that used as a kind of front?
Yes, it was. Mm-hmm. It was a storefront in a very real sense. There was may have been some blacksmithing conducted there, but it was by no means the bread and butter of that operation.
Okay, not a lot of horseshoes made there.
No.
Well, so with all of that going on, his business partners, his success, his success in the war, and what happened? What made him have to lie so much about his names and his deaths and the disappearances. What happened to his connections and his reputation to cause that break with New Orleans?
So there was a sort of a glory period after the Battle of New Orleans where he thought that he was going to be accepted into the fold, and the heroic contribution that he and his men made to the effort to defeat the British was going to be fully recognized and that he was going to be able to stay. New Orleans officials, however, had run him out of Barataria. His encampment had been burned, and sort of the court of public opinion had very much ruled he's still a pirate, even though he helped us, and it didn't turn out to be the welcoming environment that he wanted. So that is when he and Pierre moved their operations to Galveston, and this would be early, late 1810s and early 1820s. And so they set up shop there for a short time, but it was not nearly as successful as New Orleans had been. And one of the main reasons for that was Texas at that point was completely undeveloped, and they still had to move the goods that they stole back into New Orleans. And so the distance, I think, was a major factor as well. He did eventually get run out of Galveston by officials, and so he was really on walkabout at that point. Traditional piracy was super duper over at that point. The governments that had gotten absolutely tired of having their ships seized by pirates were doing a better job of making sure that the Gulf was a safer place for them, so they were patrolling more effectively. It became more difficult to get contraband into ports. We talked about the posse earlier. Those men who were around him that were his protection sort of slowly began to fall away. And so with the death of Pierre Lafitte shortly after the exit from Galveston, Jean Lafitte was really without a place, without a partner, and without a business environment that was conducive to the old way of doing business. And so he at that time, there were probably some governments that would have loved to get their hands on him as well, but we think more likely the threat of the number of people he had wronged and stolen from being out to get him made a convenient fake death and hiding under an assumed name something that would be very appealing at that sort of unsettling juncture in his life.
Let me tell people who are just tuning in, my guests by telephone are Ashley Oliphant and Beth Yarbrough, mother-daughter history author team here. Their book, Jean Lafitte Revealed, was published by the UL Press here on the UL Lafayette campus. The subtitle is Unraveling One of America's Longest Running Mysteries. So you've been talking a bit about what actually happened here in Louisiana, the Gulf Coast, that really cemented his reputation and started creating myths that many of us kind of know about more or less here in Louisiana. The two of you are from Lincolnton, which is where he died, or at least that's where his final documents are. So that's sort of where you started in your journey that actually made the bulk of this book. So once, tell us about that those initial discoveries, and then let's go back to all the hints and the whispers that you uncovered along the way. So what was it that you read that really said, yes, there's a book here?
Well, we began to discover facts about Ferrer and Lincolnton that no one had ever discovered before. And what we discovered pointed distinctly to the man Jean Lafitte. For instance, Lafitte had always surrounded himself with Freemasons. And there was never any knowledge in Lincoln County, North Carolina, that Lorenzo Ferrer, the man, had any connection to Freemasonry. But within a couple of weeks of beginning to investigate on that end, we quickly discovered that not only was Lorenzo Ferrer a Mason in Lincolnton, he was actually a founding member of the Masonic Lodge there. And when we made that discovery, we were able, very fortunate, to be invited into that Masonic Lodge by those brothers. We actually had to be voted in the door. And they opened their books to us, and their books consisted of meeting minutes all the way back to the very first founding meeting in 1852. Those meeting minutes read like a historic novel themselves. Mm-hmm. They provided abundant detail about this man that had never before been seen, and we were able to begin to piece together puzzle pieces that looked increasingly more and more, the harder we looked and the deeper we dug, that this man could easily and could probably have been the pirate Jean Lafitte. We were then tasked with taking what we looked like was going to be the truth in North Carolina and somehow walking backwards and connecting that with what we knew to be the truth about Jean Lafitte 20 years earlier. And that is how we began to pick up the trail. One other thing that researchers in North Carolina had never had the benefit of, they had tried to research Mr. Ferrer from Lincoln County outward. In other words, where did this man come from? Mm. No one had ever been able to find any trace of the man anywhere. Mm. We, on the other hand, walked into the project with a pre-existing knowledge of Lafitte's personality, traits, his habits, and the facts of his life. And that was of great benefit to us. And I will let Ashley pick it up from there and talk about how we began to close the gap between North Carolina and the Gulf.
And that was quite a journey through many states. Yeah.
So we knew that we had to prove that Ferrer and Jean Lafitte were not alive in two different locations at the same time, right? So their timelines had to be, one had to end and another one had to begin, or else we knew we weren't going to have a story. Our first hit, going back to sort of the last known Lafitte information we had, there were a lot of pings, so to speak, of him in Cuba in the last known years of his life. And so that's sort of where we began. And we got tipped off by a footnote, actually, in a book we were reading, that he may have been discussed in some correspondence between his lawyer, Edward Livingston, and his best friend, Arsène Latour. And so we drove up to Princeton, New Jersey, in search of further correspondence that might solidify what we had found. And so we were in the Princeton Library researching, looking for a letter that would reference a man named Maison Rouge. And for those of you who don't know a lot about Lafitte, when he lived in Galveston, he erected a very fine home and painted it bright red, very distinctive. That house, the red house in French, is called Maison Rouge. We knew that that was a code name for Jean Lafitte. So the letter that we found in Princeton was dated 1829, which is a full 3 years after the last Lafitte death theories subsided. And we were able to find a Maison Rouge letter so there are two in existence that we know of, with Livingston and Latour corresponding about their friend Red House, who needs help, Maison Rouge. And when we discovered it in Princeton, I'm not sure how many of you have been there, it's a very tense sort of research environment, and they do not take kindly to two women from North Carolina
whooping it up
and jumping up and down. And so we came very, very close to being kicked out of the Princeton University Library, but we didn't care because we found the Maison Rouge document. And so that document set us up for then having to figure out, all right, he's in Cuba in 1829. Where did he go from there? The answer to that is Mississippi. He came in to Capaya County, Mississippi, and we found multiple documents down there that revealed to us that that's what happened in 1830. So we went from 1829 in Cuba to 1830 in Capaya County, Mississippi, and found just an amazing amount of detail about his life in Mississippi, including a very short-lived and mysterious marriage.
And had he changed his name to Ferrer by then?
Yes.
Mississippi is when we have the first reference to him having changed his name to Lorenzo Ferrer. And what's really fascinating about that is he pops up in 1830 in Mississippi with that name. There was no man in America that had been born with the name Lorenzo Ferrer or any of its variants. Mm-hmm. No man with that name had come in through a port. No man was a member of a church or a Freemason lodge or any other organization that we could find. He just sort of appeared literally out of thin air as a full-grown man. So we knew based on that evidence that that this was someone who had changed their name.
Well, and so again, how did you first discover that name and connected him to Jean Lafitte? How did you know he had gone to Mississippi? Was that through a letter or?
Well, we found a document that connected the Lorenzo Ferrer in Lincolnton, and mm-hmm. we will tell you in a minute how mm-hmm. we know the Lorenzo Ferrer in Lincolnton was Jean Lafitte.
Okay.
So hold that.
All right. Okay.
Yeah.
Continuing on the journey.
Yeah, but to connect the Lincolnton Lorenzo Ferrer to the Mississippi Ferrer, the name Louisa, she was a beautiful octoroon woman who was unfortunately his slave. She was also his mistress. We have Louisa on a Lorenzo Ferrer document, a very detailed contract, where he actually loaned her out to another man for a year's time in Copiah County, Mississippi. Louisa's age on that document was approximately 17 years of age. When Lorenzo Ferrer arrived in Lincolnton with Louisa by his side and enough money, by the way, that he never worked a day in his life for the next 35 years before he died, her age in Lincolnton when she died matched up exactly with the age on the Mississippi document that we found. So that is how we knew that this was the same man. There was also another reason we knew that. There were three brothers named Henderson who were also living in Mississippi who crossed paths with Mr. Ferrer, and they were from Lincolnton, North Carolina. They were part of a family of 10 brothers, one of whom later went on to become the first governor of Texas, James Pinckney Henderson. All of those men were born and raised in Lincoln County, and three of them met Ferrer in Mississippi when the cotton boom, which is what brought him into the country, began to look like it was going to evaporate and money was going to be lost. Ferrer picked up Louisa and came to North Carolina, which was a much safer port. He was an older man at that point and was much less recognizable and probably felt much safer, now again surrounded by a powerful group of wealthy, influential men named Henderson. So he had a second posse and had a new place to live and felt safer. And I'm going to toss it to Ashley to give you the punchline and let you know how we actually proved that the Lincolnton Ferrer was Jean Lafitte.
So that Freemason Lodge that we mentioned earlier, Lincoln Lodge 137, we found Ferrer's initial petition to join that lodge, and we recognized then that the Henderson brothers were the ones who actually vouched for him to be accepted into the lodge. So we know for a fact that Henderson connection brought him to Lincolnton. After we had concluded our research at Freemason Lodge 137, however, it had been a few weeks, we'd put the finishing touches on the manuscript and knew we had enough proof in our hands. But we got a telephone call from one of the Freemason brothers who'd been working with us, and he said, "We think you might need to get up here." And so we said, "Okay." And so we drove up there only to discover that they had a very old sword with an iron scabbard laid out on the table. And we said, "Well, what do you have there?" And they said, "Well, this is our Tyler sword." And for your listeners that don't know, every Freemason lodge in America has an officer position called a Tyler. And that person stands at the door sort of ceremonially with a sword to guard the meeting as it unfolds. And so they said, "This is our Tyler sword. And we've consulted with our oldest members who say this sword has always hung on our wall. And we've never, aside from taking it down from the rusty nail it's been hanging on for probably, more than 100 years, we've never really taken a look at it." So we began to examine the markings and discovered that it was a War of 1812 contract cavalry saber, probably manufactured between the years 1812 and 1813, made by a man named Nathan Starr, who was the leading sword manufacturer of the day. So we were excited that we had a period sword that connected with Lafitte's life in the lodge that we knew he went on to form late in his life. What happened after that is the really surprising part. So I went home that night, the creative person that I am, could not sleep, imagining possibilities, thinking about the what ifs. And got the wild idea in the middle of the night that we didn't look at that sword very closely, and that maybe we should have a black light to go take a look. And so, very long story short, while we were in the Freemason Lodge the next day looking at the sword, we discovered that it did have an inscription that nobody had ever seen before. We needed the black light to see it. That inscription was a capital J, a lowercase n, and then a space, and then a capital L. And that was all we needed to see before we were
pretty sure
into tears, because we knew what the rest of it was going to say. It said Jean Lafitte, and it was very special, too, that it was the J-N and not J-E-A-N, because every time Lafitte ever signed his name, he never spelled it out. He always spelled it J-N.
Wow. You two are incredible sleuths. So you're not just...
We're lucky is what we are.
Well, you know, persistent and curious and willing to, you know, go the next step to discover hidden inscriptions. That is incredible. So they had never seen that in the lodge. They had never seen the inscription.
They had never seen it. And what is more, we obviously and correctly sought expert opinions about that inscription. We contacted the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, the Smithsonian, Colonial Williamsburg, some North Carolina museums, and collectively they were able to ultimately guide us to an expert in antique metals who examined this scabbard and the scratched name and verified right off the bat that this was not a new inscription scratched on an old scabbard. He said this scratched name is as old as the scabbard itself, very close in age. It had been partially filled in with some varnish or oil of some kind to protect it, I guess, from rust. And he noted that the coating also was very, very old. But under his specialized equipment, he could make out the same lettering that we could. Part of the last name is very hard to detect, but you can, with some effort, you can see it.
Well, I can only imagine if you'd have discovered that in the Princeton Library, they really would have thrown you out.
They would have taken our library card.
That's right. With all the whooping and hollering that would have been going on. What an amazing journey. And I want to remind people who are really becoming fascinated by this, my guests are authors Ashley Oliphant and Beth Yarbrough from Lincolnton, North Carolina. Their book, Jean Lafitte Revealed, Unraveling One of America's Longest Running Mysteries, was published by the UL Press here on the UL campus. They are on a book tour, and they are with us by telephone talking about their interest and their journey through this book, and that is absolutely fascinating. And so what were the details of his final years? He actually lived to be very, very old.
He did. He lived to be a 96-year-old man, and his will actually provided a wealth of information. As we noted earlier, he arrived in Lincolnton in 1839 with a great deal of money, and as far as we could determine, he never worked a single day until he died in 1875. He also notably survived the Civil War with his fortune intact, and anecdotally, most of the time, those who survived that conflict with their fortune intact had it in gold. There are some legends and myths in North Carolina about chests of gold associated with Ferrer, and we do go into detail in the book about that. However, there is no real proof. And truly, if we had, either one of us had thought that there might be buried treasure somewhere locally, we would have, long before the book hit the publication circuit, we would have dug it up. So we don't subscribe to any pirate treasure theories in North Carolina. But he was a very active man. He joined a church. He helped form this lodge. He was politically active. He loaned a lot of money. He gave toasts on the public square. So a lot of the personality traits, the same ones that had been ascribed to Jean Lafitte in his early years, were also used to describe the man Lorenzo Ferrer, right down to physical description as well. The physical descriptions of both men are identical. Even though the North Carolina description is of an older man, the traits were there. So there is an awful lot in the book about the similarities between the two. But he ultimately, we believe, just died of old age and infirmity and is buried in a very prominent grave site at St. Luke's Episcopal Church in Lincolnton, North Carolina. And Louisa is buried right beside him.
And he had very specific instructions about what his tomb was to look like.
He did. There, to our knowledge, there's only one other tabletop monument in town, and it did predate his, and it was the monument of a friend of his. So we don't know if Mr. Michael Hoke's tabletop monument is what inspired Ferrer to design his own, or if this simply just occurred to him. But it is a very unique and distinctive and recognizable grave marker.
Yeah. One of the really interesting characteristics is one of the favorite discoveries of mine that we made. There is documented evidence of Jean Lafitte having a penchant for fine beaver skin or otter skin caps. There is a documented an account of Ferrer in Lincolnton that talked about his penchant for beaver skin and otter skin caps, which is a pretty specific,
yes,
pretty specific thing to wear in that time.
What an it's fascinating. I mean, and you know what? Some people, I'm sure, hearing this description of what you all have been doing on this book are going to want to become writers themselves. It just sounds so much fun.
Well, our philosophy is you have to make your own fun because nobody is going to do that for you. So.
Well, it is evident that you all did, and you've made it fun for us and fascinating for us, and we're so grateful that you did this work and had this fun on the journey. Again, the book is Jean Lafitte Revealed, Unraveling One of America's Longest-Running Mysteries, from Barataria Bay, New Orleans, Louisiana, to Lincolnton, North Carolina, where my two guests are from and where the final resting place of Jean Lafitte has been proven to be. Should people want more information about the book, is it the UL Press website would be a good place to go?
Yes, please. That would be a great place to go. University of Louisiana Press.
All right. ulpress.org. And you can find information there. If you're passing by on campus, you can certainly go up to their offices and they have copies of the book there. Or I believe you can order it through their website also. Well, I hope you all enjoy your book tour, and I'm sure you're getting just lots of accolades and getting into some really interesting conversations as well along the way, I'm sure.
We are.
Good. Well, thank you both for taking the time. I know you have a busy day today, another interview and conversation, lecture, and a book signing as well. So we're so glad for your success, and you know, we look forward to further books by the mother-daughter team, Ashley Oliphant and Beth Yarbrough. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.